Chapter 27. The guy was finally pronounced dead 30 minutes later, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, when the doctors showed up with Pellegrino. Pellegrino was in his cruiser, and the doctor was in a fifth-hand meat wagon that looked like something out of a history book. I guessed it was a riff on a 1960s hearse, but built on a Chevrolet platform, not Cadillac, and devoid of viewing windows or other funereal hoo-ha of any kind. It was like a half-height panel van, painted dirty white. Miriam checked pulse and heartbeat and poked around the wound for a minute. He said,
"This man bled out through his femoral artery, death by gunshot."
Which was obvious, but then he added something interesting. He teased up the slit edge of the guy's pants leg and said,
"Wet denim is not easy to cut. Someone used a very sharp knife."
I helped Miriam put the guy on a canvas gurney, and then we loaded him in the back of the truck. Miriam drove him away, and Devereaux spent 5 minutes on the radio in her car. I stood around with Pellegrino. He didn't say anything, and neither did I. Then Devereaux got out of her car again and sent him about his business. He drove away, and Devereaux and I were alone once more, except for the blasted tree and the patch of dark tone on the ground where the dead guy's blood had soaked into the soil. Devereaux said,
"Butler claims no one came out of Kellum's main gate at any time this morning."
I said, "Who's Butler?"
"My other deputy. Pellegrino's opposite number. I've had him stationed outside the base. I wanted a quick warning in case they canceled the lockdown. There's going to be all kinds of tension. People are very upset about Chapman."
"But not about the first two?"
"Depends who you ask and where. But the soldiers never stop short of the tracks. The bars are all on the other side."
I said nothing. She said,
"There must be more gates, or holes in the fence. It's got to be what, 30 miles long? And it's 50 years old. Got to be weak spots. Someone came out somewhere, that's for sure."
"And went back in again," I said. "If you're right, that is. Someone went back in, bloody to the elbows, with a dirty knife, and at least one round short in his magazine."
"I am right," she said.
"I never heard of a quarantine zone before," I said. "Not inside the United States, anyway. I just don't buy it."
"I buy it," she said.
Something in her tone, something in her face. I said,
"What?
Did the Marines do this once?"
"It was no big thing."
"Tell me all about it."
"Classified information," she said.
"Where was it?"
"I can't tell you that."
"When was it?"
"I can't tell you that either."
I paused a beat and asked, "Have you spoken to Monroe yet? The guy they sent to the base?" She nodded.
"He called and left a message when he arrived, first thing, as a courtesy. He gave me a number to reach him."
"Good," I said, "because now I need to speak to him." We drove back together across Clancy's land, out his gate, south on the washboard two-lane, then west through the black half of town, away from Kellum, toward the railroad. I saw the same old women on the same front porches, and the same kids on the same bikes, and men of various ages moving slow between unknown starting points and unknown destinations. The houses leaned and sagged. There were abandoned work sites, slabs laid with no structures built on them, tangles of rusted rebar, weedy piles of bricks and sand. All around was flat tilled dirt and trees. There was a kind of hopeless, crushed torpor in the air, like there probably had been every day for the last 100 years.
My people, Devereaux said, my base, they all voted for me. I mean it, practically 100%, because of my father. He was fair to them. They were voting for him, really.
I asked, how did you do with the white folks?
Close to 100% with them, too. But that's all going to change on both ends of the deal. Unless I get some answers for all concerned.
Tell me about the first two women. Her response to that was to break sharply and twist in her seat and back up 20 yards. Then she nosed into the turning she had just passed. It was a dirt track, well smoothed and well scoured. It had a humped camber and shallow bar ditches left and right. It ran straight north and was lined on both sides with what might once have been slave shacks. Devereaux passed by the first 10 or so, passed by a gap where one had burned out, and then she turned into a yard I recognized from the third photograph I had seen. The poor girl's house, the unadorned neck and ears, the amazing beauty. I recognized the shade tree she had been sitting under, and the white wall that had reflected the setting sun softly and obliquely into her face. We parked on a patch of grass and got out. A dog barked somewhere and its chain rattled. We walked under the limbs of the shade tree and knocked on the back door. The house was small, not much bigger than a cabin, but it was well tended. The white siding was not new, but it had been frequently painted. It was stained auburn at the bottom, the color of hair, where heavy rains had bounced up out of the mud. The back door was opened by a woman not much older than either Devereaux or me. She was tall and thin, and she moved slow with a kind of sun-beat languor and with the kind of iron stoicism I imagined all her neighbors shared. She smiled a resigned smile at Devereaux and shook her hand and asked her,
"Any news about my baby?"
Devereaux said,
"We're still working on it. We'll get there in the end."
The bereaved mother was too polite to respond to that. She just smiled her wan smile again and turned to me. She said,
"I don't believe we've met."
I said, "Jack Reacher, ma'am," and shook her hand. She said,
"I'm Emmeline McClatchy. I'm delighted to meet you, sir. Are you working with the sheriff's department?"
"The army sent me to help."
"Now they did," she said. "Not 9 months ago."
I didn't answer that. The woman said,
"I have some deer meat in the pot and some tea in the pitcher. Would you two care to join me for lunch?"
Devereaux said,
"Emmeline, I'm sure that's your dinner, not your lunch. We'll be okay. We'll eat in town. But thanks anyway."
It was the answer the woman seemed to have been expecting. She smiled again and backed away into the gloom behind her. We walked back to the car. Devereaux backed out to the street and we drove away. Further down the row was a shack much like the others, but it had electric beer signs in the windows. A bar of some kind. Maybe music. We threaded through a matrix of dirt streets. I saw another abandoned construction project. Knee-high foundation walls had been built out of cinder blocks, and 4 vertical wooden posts had been raised at the corners, but that was all. Building materials were scattered around the rest of the lot in untidy piles. There were surplus cinder blocks. There were bricks. There was a pile of sand. There was a stack of bagged cement, gone all smooth and rigid with dew and rain. There was also a pile of gravel. I turned and looked at it as we drove past. Maybe 2 yards of it, the small, sharp, gray kind they mix with sand and cement to make into concrete. The pile had spread and wandered into a low hump about the size of a double bed, all weedy at the edges. It had pockmarks and divots in its top surface,
as if kids had walked on it. I didn't say anything. Devereaux's mind was already made up. She drove on and turned left into a broader street. Bigger houses, bigger yards, picket fences, not hurricane wire, cement paths to the doors, not beaten earth. She slowed and then eased to a stop outside a place twice the size of the shack we had just left. A decent one-story house. Expensive, if it had been in California, but shabby. The paint was peeling and the gutters were broken-backed. The roof was asphalt and some of the tiles had slipped. There was a boy in the yard, maybe 16 years old. He was standing still and doing nothing, just watching us. Devereaux said,
"This is the other one. Shauna Lindsay was her name. That's her baby brother right there, staring at us."
The baby brother was no oil painting. He had lucked out with the genetic lottery. That was for damn sure. He was nothing like his sister, nothing at all. He had fallen out of the ugly tree and hit every branch. He had a head like a bowling ball and eyes like the finger holes and about as close together. I asked, "Are we going in?" Devereaux shook her head.
"Shauna's mom told me not to come back until I could tell her who slit her firstborn's throat. Those were her words. And I can't blame her for them. Losing a child is a terrible thing, especially for people like this. Not that they thought their girls would grow up to be models and buy them a house in Beverly Hills, but to have something truly special meant a lot to them. You know, after having nothing else, ever."
The boy was still staring, quiet, baleful, and patient. "So let's go," I said. "I need to use the phone."